Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Andy Murray, and you're listening to The Tennis Podcast.
Well, we're at the Queen's Club, home of the Fevertree Championships, which takes place in June. But at the moment, there are no stands up. It is grey skies overhead. It is pristine green grass courts, but it is looking as though it's going to rain with no stands in sight whatsoever because it is March and the tournament is still 3 months away. However, somebody who is very well known to the crowds here at Queen's, who's won the tournament five times, a record in total, and has won Wimbledon a couple of times as well, is Andy Murray. Last time we saw him, he was at the Australian Open. He was in that press conference having just played the most extraordinary match against Roberto Bautista Agut, and we did wonder whether maybe that's it. So, since then, he's had surgery. He's had a metal joint inserted into his hip. And he was back here today at the Queen's Club to announce a new partnership with the premium British sportswear brand, Castore, a long-term deal with this company to wear their clothing. You may remember he was wearing their clothing at the Australian Open, and we got to speak to him. Let's hear that.
And is there any chance you could be available playing at Wimbledon this summer?
It's possible, but that's in terms of like time frames and stuff, because with this, I don't want like a definitive like time to try to rush back for. This isn't like, you know, this is a big surgery and operation that I've had, and I need to be smart with that and see how I'm progressing. And so far, it's been, you know, it has been good. And like I said, the main reason for me having the operation was to not be in pain anymore, and I'm not, and I'm delighted with that and really happy with that. What kind of happens next, I don't know exactly. I obviously will do the rehab as best as I can and see what's possible.
You ruled out doubles in Australia, but would you consider doing doubles to ease yourself back onto the court? Is that something that's considered?
I haven't really given that much thought, but I mean it's a possibility. If I'm not ready to play singles, that, you know, it might be a, you know, a way of kind of testing myself out to see how I'm feeling. It's not something that I would do long term, but it's, you know, it's a possible stepping stone, I guess, to maybe getting back to playing singles again. But yeah, I haven't given that too much thought.
Would you need a warm up tournament, Andy, before you got back into a slam?
Yeah, I think it'd be a smart thing to do. I mean, you know, I also myself just wouldn't feel comfortable doing that, like going straight into a slam without having any preparation or at least seeing how it feels. I think I would hate to go on the court like at Wimbledon and something bad to happen, or me to feel really bad and apprehensive and things and it to go really badly. Like, I wouldn't want that to happen. So yeah, I would certainly need to play some stuff in the build-up if I was going to try and do that.
Okay, what does your kind of rehab involve, and when do you think you might be able to kind of get back on court to, you know, some extent?
Well, maybe be hitting some balls, like, so stationary. So this is not what I have to do to compete, just hitting tennis balls on a court from about 2 to 2.5 months, you know, which is probably in about 4 weeks' time. The operation was 5 weeks yesterday. And so each day, basically, so yesterday, for example, I did 45 minutes of my physio. I then did an hour in the swimming pool. I then did weights for an hour with like 15, 20 minutes of cardio stuff on a bike and on a cross trainer. And then I went home and did, I have got one of those like Alter G machines in my house to help with my walking, to get my gait back, because obviously I've been limping for 18 months, and even though I don't have pain when I walk now, my initial thing when I stand up from this chair will be to limp, so I need to work on that all the time. So I'm doing like, 40 minutes of kind of walking each day on this machine, which allows you to adjust your body weight. So I'm walking at like 85-90% of my body weight now, which is good, and walking quite well with that. And then I went back in the pool, did about half an hour in the pool, and then some more exercises for about 45 minutes or so to try and work on my range of motion, because that's the thing that's kind of hardest to get back if you leave that at the beginning and don't take care of that. So the strength, obviously, I can build up over a longer period, but if I just sat and didn't work on the range of motion, my hip would just stiffen up and everything around it. So I need to work on that quite a lot, and that's quite uncomfortable. Like, the other stuff is actually okay, but the range of motion stuff is pretty uncomfortable.
And Andy, when we saw you in that press conference at the Australian Open, the one before your match, you were talking about trying to find an end point really to your career that you'd be comfortable with. Is it fair to say that you feel very differently about your prospects now?
No, I don't feel differently about it. I mean, like I said, I needed an end point to the pain. The end point was not necessarily to stop my career. I throughout the whole process, I always wanted to continue playing, but I didn't want to be in pain anymore. And obviously, even if I was not going to play tennis again, I would have had to have had an operation, because I tried everything to try to get rid of the pain. And the operation has taken that pain away. And I'm really, really happy about that as a person. Like, you know, I feel great. Like, when I wake up in the morning, I'm not stressed by hip pain all of the time. And now I'm just going to try my best to see how good I can make my hip. And I don't know where that will take me. And that was also the case, you know, in Australia, is that I don't have any reference. Like, no one's done an operation like this and gone back to playing, so it was never considered. And the amount of doctors and specialists that I'd spoken to, it was not an option to have this surgery. And if it was, if someone had told me 2 years ago, you're going to be in lots and lots of pain, have this surgery now, you'll be back playing in 5 months, I would have gone, oh, absolutely, I'll do it. But that was never what I was told, and that's why, you know, I ended up, you know, having the surgery, was to get rid of pain, not to start playing tennis again. But that's what I love doing. And if there's a possibility, like someone like Bob Bryan, you know, has come back and is doing good, but it's doubles, and there's a huge difference between the two in terms of the loads that you put on the body and the stresses you put on your joints, and it's not quite the same, but it shows that there's a level that you can get to, and it's just whether or not I can do better than that.
Is part of the challenge, Andy, that keeps you going, the reason that people say, well, you can't do this, it's never been done before, is that part of what keeps you going, to prove people wrong?
With this, it actually isn't. I think throughout large parts of my career, that's something that has kind of motivated me a lot, but that really hasn't in this. It's just that I really like playing tennis, so if I can come back and play paint, like, I was playing tennis for 18 months and it was horrible. Like, it was not fun, it was really painful, training wasn't fun, matches weren't fun, I wasn't getting any enjoyment out of winning matches. I remember when I won my first match during the grass season against Stan, I wasn't happy after the match because my hip was killing me. Like, and I thought after 6 months and a surgery or 12 months of playing, I'd be really happy with that, and that wasn't the case. So it's not about proving anyone wrong or being the first person to do it. It's just, tennis is something that I love doing, I really enjoy it, and if my hip allows me to do that, then without pain, and I can still enjoy it, then I would like to try. But if I can't, then I can, and I'll be happy that I'm not in pain every day.
Do you feel in a much better place mentally when you've got such a better quality of life with no pain in your hip now?
Yeah, and it makes a huge difference. Like, to, you know, I can go walk around the block like with my kids and go on scooter and things like that, and you know, these are small things that might, but that the thought of doing that like 6 weeks ago or 2 months ago was like, no, I can't do that because my hip hurts, and then I have to train and I have to play after doing that, and that also is going to hurt. So, you know, it's just, it's like small things like that are fine for me to do. I have no restrictions on what I can and can't do now. Like, you know, well, I'm not supposed to run for, you know, 2.5-3 months, but in terms of, you know, going out and doing stuff, like, you know, I have no restrictions now, and I had big restrictions on just my life for a year, 18 months.
When do you think you'll have a clearer idea of when you might be able to come back? Does that make sense?
I would think like around the 4 month mark, because I think like that's when I'm allowed to start doing like high impact activity. So, you know, obviously in the meantime I can try and get my leg as strong as possible and you know, get the range of motion as good as I can, and then I have to just be patient to wait for the time when I'm allowed to go and try and run on a tennis court, and then I'll have an idea. And the thing is, because I have lots of, you know, tests from over the years in terms of like my speed and my strength and things, that I can look back at that and go, yeah, well, I'm way slower than I was before. And if that's the case, like if I'm much slower than I was, let's say in Australia, you know, I'm not just going to go and play. Like, if, you know, I can't move properly, like I want to be able to run around like, you know, like I used to and stuff. So I'll need to make a decision based on those things as well. If actually fit, if I'm not in pain, but physically I'm just not the same or a long way from that, then that will also factor into it as well.
So playing singles at Wimbledon, on that basis, still a possibility. Is it an aim?
It's a possibility, but it's not an aim. Yeah, my goal isn't to be back playing tennis for Wimbledon. Like, the thing is, if things were going really well and I was continuing to progress, but I didn't just feel like I was quite ready, then, well, surely it makes sense for me to wait and potentially have, you know, play for longer than just one tournament, rather than being like, okay, I need to rush back because it's Wimbledon and it's a little bit too soon and I screw things up and waste the last, you know, 5-6 months of rehab. So, yeah, it's not my aim. But yeah, if I could play at Wimbledon, I would love to do that. Of course, it's my favourite tournament to play.
And just back on the operation, when you had it, was the surgeon happy with the way everything went, and are the medical people happy with the way your rehabilitation has gone so far?
Yeah, so I had it Wednesday today, Tuesday? What day is it? So on Monday I had my 5-week checkup. So I had a 2-week checkup and then a 5-week checkup. After 2 weeks, I'm still on crutches, not really walking, and then now I'm, you know, crutch-free walking, and had the x-ray yesterday or 2 days ago to make sure that the prosthesis hasn't moved in that time, which it hadn't. And she seemed very happy with, you know, where it was at after 5 weeks, and also just from talking to me how I felt about it, and I'm really happy with it because I'm not in pain. So it's been good so far, and regardless of what happens, I'm happy that the decision was made to have it done, because now I know the next 10 years or whatever, how long it lasts, will be a lot more enjoyable. So it's been good so far.
Is this the toughest battle of your career, because it's the unknown, it's out of your control, there's so many variables that have to come together?
No, the last 18 months were by far the hardest for me. That, like, now it's sort of, I don't feel like I'm battling against anything now. I'm just kind of waiting to see and doing all of the rehab as best as I can, and then hopefully it works out well. Whereas the last 18 months, I mean, I was battling through, just a lot of pain and discomfort, and trying to trying to compete, and that was I didn't particularly enjoy the last 18 months at all. So it just doesn't feel like a battle anymore, which is it did feel a bit like that the last little while.
And it was in London. And how long was the operation? Just the details of the operation.
The operation is supposed to be like 45 minutes, but mine took a bit longer because my bone was really, really strong, so it took a while to get the prosthesis in to my bone. So it took like an hour and a half, 2 hours, which I think everyone was a bit worried about when they were in the waiting room. They were told they would be back up in 45 minutes, and it was like 2.5 hours later, I wasn't back yet. But yeah, I mean, I had it done in London, and the surgeon was Sarah Muirhead Allwood, and I had it done at Princess Grace Hospital, and yeah, it was great. I was in there I had it done on Monday morning or Monday midday or something like that, Monday morning, and then I was out on Thursday evening, and yeah.
Why did you choose her? Last one, thanks.
Because she was honest with me. You know, over this kind of period, I've spoken to a lot of people and different specialists and surgeons and stuff that have sort of maybe told me that things were going to work out better than what they had. And I felt, speaking to her, that she told me the truth, and that, you know, that there's absolutely no guarantees that you get back to playing, and that you just have to see how it goes, and that, you know, it just felt right having spoken to her, because I didn't want to be told, like, you're going to come back and win Wimbledon in 5 months and you're going to be feeling perfect, because I know that it's not the case, and nobody in their right mind could promise me that, because it's not been done before. So I just felt like she told me the truth and honestly how she felt about it. And she didn't say to me, never try and play again. It was just like, just be realistic, and, you know, this might not work out, but what I can guarantee you is that your pain will be gone. And that's happened. So that was why I went with her.
Thank you.
So, Andy Murray in very talkative form and a very different look on his face than the last time we saw him. You may remember the press conference we described to you when he said he thinks that's it, that he was just trying to get through to play Wimbledon to call an end to his career because the pain was so severe. And then we had what looked like an on-court celebration of his career and a goodbye from the Australian Open after that Bautista-Agut match. He didn't know then whether he would play again, and he still doesn't know whether he's going to play again. But with Matt here, Grad Matt, and Simon Briggs, we've all just been at that press conference, it's nice to see him looking a bit happier.
Yeah, that's the main takeaway before you even start to go into the details, isn't it? Because in Australia, he was certainly at a very low point in the famous Firth press conference, where my colleague Eleanor Crooks asked him, "How are you, Andy?" And he couldn't really speak. And then when he came in to speak to us, he was actually, it was a bit, some people felt it was almost a bit like a therapy session. And he opened up, but he obviously, it wasn't a joyful occasion. It was a very interesting chat. So to come here and see him laughing a little bit and making a couple of jokes and just seeming a lot more comfortable with himself. I mean, Andy's he's a very entertaining guy most of the time. Maybe he doesn't always come across to the public when you see him interviewed in a formal setting, but he's anyone who works with him behind the scenes knows that he's got a lot of character and a lot of humour, and that's kind of returned, hasn't it?
Did any of what he said there today surprise you? Because we talked briefly afterwards, and I think we were trying to work out, well, where is that compared to where we were a month ago? I mean, there was a difference even in the 3 days between the two press conferences that he did, wasn't there? But this, I mean, his outlook was so much more positive that it certainly made me think, well, I think he's going to play again. I don't know where, I don't know when, but I think he is. What do you think?
Yeah, but I think that's kind of beyond our ken. It's sort of beyond his ken. It's beyond the medical profession's ken, because no one's tried to do it before, and that was what he told us. But so it was like a real emotional change today, and not really a factual change. There's an awful lot of really interesting stuff. I mean, I was fascinated by the fact that he'd chosen the surgeon because she had been straight with him. You know, he hadn't gone with the guy everyone was talking about in New York, who was a bloke who'd taken a number of American athletes and put them back on the playing field, but you know, obviously I had a bit of bluster and promotion maybe that went with his package, and that was what I was hearing sort of behind the scenes, that maybe Andy wanted somebody who would tell it to him straight. So I think it's unknowable, but it's just how the same story in bleak factual terms can be told in two very different ways depending on where you are emotionally.
Yeah, they can. Actually, on the drive down to Queens today, I got a chance to speak to Catherine Whittaker, who's in Indian Wells at the moment, ahead of the tournament starting there. She's going to be presenting Prime Video's coverage. And the one thing she said when I told her I was coming to see Andy Murray was, see if you can find out who his surgeon was, because I need to have exactly the same thing done. So now we know. I haven't even had to ask him on the quiet. He's let us all know. And so there you go, Catherine. She'll tell you the truth, just how bad it is, and whether you're going to ever get back out on the court and have that rematch against me, which I know you don't want to have. What did you make, Matt, of what you saw from Andy Murray out there today? I mean, you were in Melbourne as well.
Yeah, I mean, it couldn't really be more different. I mean, the last time we saw him, he'd just gone through a 4 or 5 hour match with the pit bull that is Bautista Agut, and he looked like a broken man, really, sort of emotionally and physically. He said he couldn't really walk, and today I thought it was really interesting how he said his default setting now is to limp, and he's got to get that range of motion back, and you see that he is still limping around, but in himself, he's so much happier. It's just nice to see him smiling. Whether he's able to make a comeback, as Simon says, I'm not sure anything's necessarily changed today in terms of that. But at least he's talking positively. At least it's still a possibility. It's possible that the hip resurfacing could have gone badly, but it didn't. It went well. So he's in a better place, and that makes me, and I think everyone, will feel better just knowing that he's happier.
Yeah. And I think there is that intangible something about Andy Murray, having covered him for so long and been around him, that makes me feel that even despite the facts, I just think it's possible because it's him and what he's like. But I found the comments about the testing that he's going to put himself through to see whether he's anywhere close to where he used to be interesting. But even with that, we were talking about the possibility of at least playing a little bit of doubles maybe with Jamie. I remember asking Jamie about that at the Australian Open, and he certainly seemed up for it as well. We have not seen the last of him on a tennis court, I don't think.
Yeah, I mean, I would be really, really surprised if he doesn't play anything. That would be, I think the scale of our possible outcomes has definitely shifted on the spectrum, hasn't it? When I asked him in Australia if he was considering playing doubles, he gave me a one-word answer. It was no, wasn't it?
Yes. I mean, I suppose he might have been taking that to mean, you know, to become a doubles player.
Yeah.
But which we didn't really push, did we? We didn't really push to say, well, what about, you know, a goodbye just on the doubles court? But yeah, I mean, you're right. It was a flat no.
And that's definitely changed as he's considered where he wants to go. And I think that was the minimum now. That if he didn't play a doubles tournament, I'd be shocked. And, you know, whether he can play a singles tournament, as he said, it's just in the lap of the gods a little bit. All I would say is if anyone can do it, Andy can. I mean, that was very much the message that I got from Jamie Delgado in September, actually, before the US Open. You know, he was still in that position that we were all in, and Andy's in, of not really knowing how the body will respond. And he just kept on telling me that, you know, he had faith that this is a guy who will stop at absolutely nothing. And to see the frame of mind he's in now, so positive, it only underlines that.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, Tennis Podcast listeners. David here. Now, you might know that I love a bit of cooking, and I think I'm quite good at it. But if I'm honest, even I get fed up trying to work out what to do every night. That's where Home Chef comes in. Being able to put together a delicious meal without the long prep and the cook times, well, that's pretty cool. Home Chef provides fresh ingredients and chef-designed recipes conveniently delivered to your doorstep to simplify your cooking experience. They have over 30 options a week and serve a variety of dietary needs, so you don't have to worry about what to make ahead of time. Not only is it convenient, but it's economical too. Home Chef customers save an average of $86 per month on groceries. Now, for a limited time, Home Chef is offering Tennis Podcast listeners 18 free meals plus free dessert for life and, of course, free shipping on your very first box. Go to homechef.com/tennis. That's homechef.com/tennis for 18 free meals and free dessert for life. You heard it right. I mentioned Prime Video coverage of Indian Wells, which starts today, actually, in the women's event starts today. The men's event starts tomorrow. I know Dan Evans is in qualifying tonight to try to get into the main draw, but political shenanigans continue, I understand, Simon. Last time we spoke to you at the Australian Open, there was all the stuff going around about the head of the ATP, Chris Kermode's future, and I think he's in the final year, isn't he, of his contract and whether it would be renewed. What's the latest?
Well, we're still early in the what's going to be a ongoing week of many meetings, and the news overnight was that David Egdes has been confirmed in a full position as a player's representative on the ATP board. The Sports Business Journal wrote a very interesting piece, writing that Justin Gimelstob is the main a person who wants a change of leader at the top of the ATP, possibly not the end of this year. The most common theory going around the corridors of tennis is that they would hand Chris one more year to make it easier to find a replacement. The SBJ article suggested if that happened, he'd be a lame duck. I mean, that's possibly one perspective on it. The chance of that all going through has been seriously strengthened, I would say, by the fact that Egdes has been confirmed as a player representative, because he's absolutely a staunch ally of Gimelstob and has rarely been known to diverge from Gimelstob's position on anything.
Mm. We don't get it, do we? I mean, I know we get on, certainly I get on very well with Chris Kermode, known him for a long time. I just, you know, just don't get it.
Yeah, I mean, one thing I would query, I mean, the Sports Business Journal article is very interesting, well-informed. It's not easy for anyone to read it, unfortunately, because it's behind a pretty heavy paywall. But it also says, not every player is against Kermode. Well, that is, in my opinion, somewhat of an understatement. I mean, we asked Roger, we asked Rafa, we asked Stan, didn't we? Every player almost outside, like the fingers of one hand, you could almost number the players who want to change. Unfortunately, there's 10 people, unfortunately for Chris, there's 10 people on the player council, and those, that finger of one hand, are all on the player council. There's very few people who's not on that player council who's pushing for a change. So,
well, what is their problem? I mean, is it just straightforward money?
Well, I mean, Novak's spoken about his desire to set up a players' union. Well, actually, not on the record, has he? But he certainly briefed the player group in Australia just over a year ago that was what he wanted to do. He certainly seems to feel that the players need to be more aggressive. And that would require, for it to actually work, it would require a total reorganisation of the way the whole ATP works. And you can argue, and Pospisil, who's one of the anti-faction, did this in a letter during the Australian Open that was leaked, You can argue that the ATP is not fit for purpose because it's always deadlocked by the clash between the employers and the employees who want different things. Well, that's a fair enough position. I certainly wouldn't dispute that. Whether or not you can blame the guy at the top for the constitution he's inherited is another issue. But those guys aren't happy. Justin Gimelstob has his own reasons, I think. I don't think he and Chris get on. I still would point out that Justin Gimelstob is facing a potential criminal trial and query whether he should be on the ATP board in the first place. So it's not an entirely edifying spectacle.
No, that's certainly without question. The tennis itself, the draws have now been made. I saw all of the women's draw in detail because that was the day earlier. The one thing that did strike me was the draw of Serena Williams, who starts with Victoria Azarenka and then could face Garbiñe Muguruza in the second round match that she plays in order to, you know, start making waves in the draw. I mean, that is just an absolute horror draw, isn't it?
It doesn't go all the way up. There's Muguruza in there. There's
Sloane Stephens, I think, and then there's Simona Halep. It would be the final opponent, I think, isn't it? Right, Matt?
Yeah. So the way we've got it laid out here is Azarenka, Muguruza, Bertens, Stephens, Halep, Osaka. I mean, these things almost never happen like that. But all of those people have beaten Serena Williams, interestingly.
She's going to have to play like Serena, and then she might be all right. So what else strikes you from the draws that we've seen so far? Katie Bolter, I know, lost in the qualifying. Johanna Kontra, I think, plays today against Pauline Parmentier. What else is of note?
Well, an interesting thing in the women's draw is Osaka potentially playing Kiki Mladenovic again, who just beat her in Dubai, wasn't it? So that's a potentially immediate chance for revenge there. In the men's draw, I think most people have got their eye on the potential third rounds between Federer and Wawrinka and Novak Djokovic and Nick Kyrgios, which...
Oh, yeah, that'll do.
They both need to win one match for that to happen. And it's funny, isn't it? Because kind of thinking about the last few weeks on the men's tour that we've seen, it's just been so open because, quite frankly, Djokovic hasn't been there. Suddenly Djokovic comes back and you're kind of having to squint to see a possibility that isn't Djokovic winning it. But Kyrgios would be certainly one of the guys, if he plays like he did in Acapulco, who you might think would have a chance of taking him down.
What do you think of what you've witnessed over the last couple of weeks? I mean, Tsitsipas has had his results. Kyrgios has won this tournament out of nowhere because he's had no form, has he, for 18 months. And Federer's won his 100th.
Well, it's been absolutely brilliant. I mean, this is a hard time for me to get tennis in the paper with the Six Nations on. But there's been some great storylines, and I've actually had some quite serious space. And that wouldn't have happened if it had just been, you know, a kind of regulation fortnight or so. But it has been riveting. And yes, as Matt says, Novak could squash the intrigue a little bit, couldn't he, by just being too good for the field. I mean, you can't blame him for that. He's just... on a different plane. But I mean, in the final against Rafa in Australia, there was one point where he just seemed to press a button on one side of the court and he was on the other side of the court, and he seemed to have just done that thing in Rent-A-Ghost where you kind of, when you don't even move in between the intervening space. I just couldn't believe it.
Have you ever heard of Rent-A-Ghost, Matt?
No.
That was the 80s show. When were you born?
96.
Oh, for God. Go away. Let's go and have our own podcast over here, Simon. Kyrgios, whenever I text you, you seem to be loving the fact that Nick Kyrgios is relevant again because you are writing about him and people seem to like that.
Yeah, well, I think I tweeted that nobody has appeared in my back page column more often than its 9 years of existence than Nick Kyrgios. I feel a bit bad for leaning on him so much for content, but it's just that kind of... it's that Marmite factor that makes him irresistible, and everyone's got an opinion, and there's no real right or wrong, I think, because he is brilliant and he can be awful. I mean, he can be a real pain in the arse, and he has been certainly on certain occasions I've been trying to interview him, but he has also been very good on other occasions, so you just don't know what's going to happen next, but it's just compelling.
But that's the thing about Kyrgios, like, he should be a player that evokes passion. You know, you should say, oh, I love him or I hate him. But the past 12 months, I've kind of felt indifferent towards him because he's just not been performing. Like, You want, if you're going to put your energy into someone, you want to see it. You want to see them put energy in and effort in as well. He's not really just, he's not been that relevant for 12, 18 months, probably since he won Brisbane at the start of last year. But now to have him back, and suddenly, you know, Twitter just goes mad when Kyrgios is playing. And, you know, some people probably need to chill out. Like, you know, he's not perfect, but who is? And just enjoy him for what he is, because he makes it more interesting whether you like him or don't like him, and that can only be a good thing, I think.
Yeah. Incidentally, we talked about Djokovic just there. Don't you think it's the ultimate power play that he's done absolutely nothing for the last month and just let these people, you go and have your own game. You go and have your own game, and I'll come out for the proper stuff.
Well, I hadn't thought of it like that, but I suppose it does show a certain amount of self-assurance. I mean, he obviously has spoken about wanting to have a better work-life balance, I guess, put it in one way, and wanting to spend more time with his family. Whether that makes him a better player, we'll see, I guess. And one would suspect, on the basis of the last 6 months, that he's going to be stronger for the fact that he's come out of a slump and rediscovered his best form. And you know, we're looking at the Indian Wells and Miami Sunshine Double, but then it's all going to be about Paris, isn't it, before long? So yeah, Novak's going to be the centre of attention for the next few months.
But that's the Djokovic playbook, isn't it, to just sweep the big events and rest when others are kind of killing themselves out on the tour. He's done that for years. He's played such a light schedule compared to so many.
But I was looking at 2 years ago, I remember us commenting on the fact that he played Acapulco when he was dominating, and we didn't really get it, or rather when he was coming back from that period, wasn't he? And I thought, you know, wouldn't you want to rest at that point?
Well, I think then he was searching a bit for something, wasn't he? When he knows he's got it, he's so comfortable with taking weeks off. Like when he was in his peak, sort of 14, 15, 2016, that sort of time. If you look at his schedule, it was really quite light compared to a lot of the other guys, and he's gone back to that now.
Just on the subject of the women's world number one, she's posted a very, very heartfelt account of how she's feeling at the moment, and really an optimistic one, taking a leaf out of Andy Murray's book a little today, in which she says, "I'm writing this now to organise my thoughts and try to put into words what I've been feeling. A lot of parents have been coming up to me and telling me that their kids look up to me, and those words literally blew me away. I was so shocked and felt this huge responsibility because I remembered how important my role models are. Also, the fact that parents themselves were telling me this meant they approved, which is mind-blowing to me." It's important for her, isn't it, to sort of organize her emotions, I think, around what is happening to her, because she's becoming so big right now, Simon. I mean, this, you know, Matt talks about Nick Kyrgios, what happens when he plays on Twitter. I'm blown away by the reaction that a tweet from Osaka gets now, and it's going to multiply, and she's going to need to find this way of being okay with it all, and that's what she's written here. I feel is quite a nice way of looking at it.
Yeah, it's interesting because she obviously has something of a roller coaster in her attitude towards the tour. Sometimes she doesn't seem to be enjoying it as much as others. We've seen her, I think there was a, I heard that she'd been emotional in a different way, talking, maybe was it Courtney Nguyen? She did an interview with her about how she was really struggling to deal with the attention that came with her success, and it wasn't natural for her, and she'd actually been in tears. That was what I heard.
Yeah.
So, in a way, I was just thinking, it's almost like we've forgotten that most people find the tour difficult because we've been focused on the big four men. And in a way, the big four men, one of the things that they've done is they've made being a professional tennis player look quite sort of easy, in the sense that, all right, Andy was sometimes wild-haired and wild-eyed on the court, but he always said he liked touring, and all four of them seem to be adapted totally to this kind of weird lifestyle. But if you go back, actually, they're, in some ways, they're the anomalies, aren't they? Because, you know, McEnroe, Agassiz, you know, all these people, they struggle with the life, and maybe actually finding it difficult to be a person living out of a suitcase is more common, and being in the public eye, as Naomi's issue sounds like, it's more about the attention than it is about the travel. Those things are actually more normal, and it's almost like Serena had different approach, didn't she, in the sense that she disappeared for quite long periods and took up other interests. But the way that people deal with the tour is becoming a story in the case of Azarkar. It's a story in the case of Kyrgios, because a lot of the things that make him compelling are his internal battles and what's going through his head. You just never know what state of mind he's going to be in.
No.
But maybe, as I say, this is actually almost more human than the kind of extraordinary natural ease with which the Big Four went about being 24/7, 52-week-a-year tennis players.
You've worked in cricket, which is even more grueling as a travel job, isn't it? I mean, you know, wonderful as well. You go to these incredible places and so forth. How do you find the touring life? I mean, it's not normal life, is it?
Well, the difference with cricket is surely that it's the team sport, so you're always with your family. I mean, unless you're KP in his last days, when you're the black sheep in the eyes of most of the rest of the team. I mean, for me, I only do 3 months on the road a year, so I'm nowhere near the 40 weeks that these big guys are doing. I'm just really thinking on my feet, really. I haven't really thought about this before, but just in terms of the difference between an Azarkar or a Kyrgios, who are very different cases, I'm not trying to lump them together, but them and the kind of the Federers, who just make it look so easy and have done for years. Maybe the Federers are the anomalies, not the other two.
Yeah, I actually think that's true. I think Federer is and Serena Williams, I think they're extraordinary, that their love of it all.
But Serena didn't have that, did she? I mean, she finds it difficult in a different way to motivate herself for tour events, which Federer never seemed to have. But she doesn't find it difficult to motivate herself for the big ones.
No. Oh, it's all good fun to talk about. We could do it all day. That's what we do, really, isn't it, on a weekly basis here on the Tennis Podcast. Thank you, Simon, for joining us here at the Queen's Club. It's been a nice morning, hasn't it, to see Andy in good spirits and to see this place looking nice and green and ready for what will come in a few months' time. What are your next movements? Where are you going next?
I'm going to Miami. It's Indian Wells is always a nightmare for papers, because this is the end of the Six Nations and Cheltenham Festival next week. So I've always found Indian Wells. I've never actually been. It doesn't work in terms of a very kind of like in-house production issue. So Miami on Monday week.
Excellent. We'll look forward to speaking to you from there. You can tell us all about it and the new stadium that they've got there at the Hard Rock Stadium, isn't it?
Yeah, it's basically being built on the side, as I understand it, of the Miami Dolphins base.
Oh, wow. That is going to be quite something. Right, Matt, we better go and edit this podcast. It's been a great morning, hasn't it? Very interesting.
Very. I mean, I was initially struck just to turn up at Queen's and see it like this.
Is this the first time you've ever seen it like this? Basically, just to let you know, if you've ever been to Queen's or if you've seen it on the telly, it's these massive, great big stands with 9,500 seats in. There are none of those here now. Nothing. There's a clubhouse. There's a couple of hard courts where the big stand gets built on. There's a car park where the other stand at the end gets looked on, which you see from the television camera point of view. And then you've got a patch of green grass that looks like it's about to be played bowls on.
Yeah, it was the car park that struck me. I was like, oh, that's not usually there. But yeah, I suppose that's the nice thing about Queen's, isn't it? It's a club the rest of the year, and you know, if you turn up at, you know, if you were to go to Melbourne Park now, it would probably look quite like it does for the tournament. But here, it's a real transformation, and that's quite exciting. I think when the tournament's on, for everyone arriving, you know, there's a real buzz, and the people who are here get to see that the whole year.
Wonderful. Right. Well, we will be back with another tennis podcast on probably Monday. Yes, Monday, when we finally worked out the time difference with Catherine, because she and I are having a few funny phone calls in the middle of the night where I've not quite worked it out. And we'll be back and we'll speak to you soon.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered?
here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.